Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. Strong Santa Ana winds roaring through our region have fueled multiple wildfires this week. The largest has thus far burned over 850 acres and on Tuesday forced evacuation of 5,000 homes or an estimated 20,000 residents in north-central San Diego County. The Bernardo Fire threatened homes in Rancho Bernardo, Rancho Santa Fe, and several other neighboring communities. Firefighters continue dousing hot spots in the Bernardo Fire area. A new fire near Palomar Airport in Carlsbad has forced evacuation of Poinsettia Elementary School on Wednesday afternoon as we tape this show. On Tuesday, a fire in Campbell burned a structure, and downed power lines also sparked a brush fire in the Dulzura area along Highway 94. Numerous power outages have occurred across our region. As of Wednesday today, SDG&E warns that it may proactively shut off power in windy areas to prevent its lines from sparking more fires, so be prepared for power outages. CAL FIRE also asks that if you have not already prepared defensible space around your home, now is the time to do so. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in the San Diego Performance Academy. And today, my guest is Tony Tiora. Tony is a Republican candidate running in the state Assembly 71st District against incumbent Brian Jones. And this is an interesting race in that both candidates are Republican. There's actually no Democrat or any other minor party candidates declared in the race, although we have heard that there is a write-in candidate Democrats may be fielding, and if so, we'll certainly try to get some information and invite all of the candidates in the race, including Brian Jones, on the show. Tony, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Miriam. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I think that's what's great about America is the opportunity. So I want to thank you.
Absolutely. And we're certainly committed to bringing all voices in the community out there, and especially those candidates you might not hear about in other media. Tony, tell us a little bit about your background, for starters, your experience and qualifications for the job, so to speak.
Okay. I'm not a native of California. I've lived here off and on for about 10 years, mm-hmm. but I grew up in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and you know, I love the East Coast, but I came here for a couple trips, and I fell in love with the weather like a lot of other folks do, and came out here in 94. I ended up going to Japan from that trip because when I came here in 94, there really wasn't a great economy. So I took a job working for the military teaching computer science. Mm. But I grew up in New Jersey, just a working class family. My dad had actually immigrated from Italy. He passed away, unfortunately, when I was a little kid, and it made times a little bit tough for our family. But I worked really hard, and my dad instilled in me that education was really important, and if you work hard in America, anything's possible. And I really believe that. And I worked hard in school, had like I think they gave like a grammar school award, like quarter champion, and like won mm-hmm. like the science award. I eventually got a scholarship from a group called The Better Chance. I think the governor of Massachusetts had the same scholarship. They gave opportunities mostly to minorities, mostly to African Americans. I think I was like one of the first white kids to get the scholarship. So I was really flattered and pleased, and I really appreciate what they did. I ended up going to school in private school at Moses Brown Boarding School for high school for mm-hmm. a couple of years. And after high school, I went to Rutgers on a scholarship.
Rutgers?
Rutgers College of Engineering. And I finished up in 1987.
So you are an engineer by profession.
That's correct.
And I understand that you also write science fiction novels.
One of my dreams as a kid, I mean, even though I studied like engineering and science, all the kids love Star Trek and stuff like that. And I started writing. I actually have a book that I wrote like in 1988, and I looked at it recently, and I joke around my wife that anybody ever publishes it, I'll sue them because, my writing was just horrible back then. But it took many years, and finally got a small little publisher, and I've been published. And I do it mostly as a hobby. I get royalties, but, mm-hmm. You know, I have a new book out, actually just came out within the last week or so. But I've been doing it off and on for 20 years now.
Very interesting. Well, things can be pretty surreal up there in Sacramento when the legislature gets heated, so that might wind up being a pretty good training. Who knows?
Yeah, I think some of it's definitely science fiction, especially some of the stuff that I read recently about Brian Jones with that whole thing with Lord Mockham and whatnot that I read about.
Yeah, let's get into the campaign itself now. I always like to ask a challenger who's going up against somebody in their own party, as you are here, what is the reason that made you decide to get into the race? And obviously there must be some areas where you differ with the incumbent. What are they?
Well, that's totally true, Miriam. You know, when I look at what happens in Washington and also in local politics, I've been watching this for years. You know, my friends and I, we talk about these things around the coffee, water cooler, having a cup of coffee and whatnot. And I'm just so tired of complaining about what's going on. You know, right now we have two parties that are really running the show, obviously the Republicans and the Democrats. And in California, it's a democratically controlled state. But, the way I look at it is you don't even need most of these folks in Sacramento. You could just get a robot and say, okay, you're a Republican and click this lever and you're a Democrat and click this lever. You know, there's very few folks that are centrist that can cross party lines and use their brains nowadays.
So you've said you consider yourself to be a centrist and that you have differences not only with some of Assemblyman Jones's policies, but with the Republican Party overall.
You know, when I look at Jones's voting record, I always say that it's not what you say, it's what you do. And when you look at people's voting records, that tells you a lot of what's going on. And you can look at that both for the Democratic and Republicans. But the Republican Party, I think, for example, talks a lot about things, for example, like immigration. I saw a thing of Brian Jones saying you got to put up a fence and this and that. Well, the truth is that we encouraged, unfortunately, a lot of this, illegal immigration, the undocumented workers that are here. You know, they're part of America. And the Republican Party seems to take a very hard stance, like they're going to, send, a lot of these undocumented workers back and create all kinds of laws that I think that are going to be kind of pushing backwards. I think we have to, illegal immigration, I think we have to find ways for the folks that are here to take these undocumented workers and bring them into mainstream society. Mm-hmm. I see things like the Republicans, voting against, things like the minimum wage, for example. Now, I understand that things like the minimum wage, businesses, some small businesses might have an issue with that. But, nobody can really live on the California minimum wage. And because of that, we have a high level of people on food stamps and things like that. So people are actually working and then they're collecting government money from food stamps.
Well, yeah, which actually winds up costing the government money. It's an interesting point. Now, another issue you've mentioned where you have some differences with the incumbent is on the issue of climate change and what to do about that. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Well, climate change is a very hot political topic because it's also something that the two parties have completely polarized, and I think they've brainwashed folks on actually both ends of the aisle. For example, climate change, to me, it's about science. I consider myself, even though I'm an engineer, a scientist. And, either the climate's getting warmer or it's not. It's just mathematics. You can take a look at the map and say, hey, as the years are getting hotter or colder. I think that anybody of real intelligence understands that the climate has been getting warmer over the ages. For example, if you look at the 21st century, we've had, I think, 9 out of the 10 top, years and temperatures that have gone up. The hottest years on record, you see the things of storms increasing, Katrina, Sandy. You're going to get that in the winter too, because it's going to the greenhouse effect is created from carbon dioxide. If you look at the studies, you can say, well, carbon dioxide was maybe 180 or 200 parts per million, 100 years ago, and now it's doubled, right?
Yeah.
So is that man-made? Yeah, probably. Is it possible that there's some natural cycle involved with ice ages and things like that? Yeah, true. That's possible too. But I think you have to look at the science, and the scientists that are looking at this will tell you that most of this is anthropogenic or, it's man-made.
Yeah, it's something like 97% of all the climatologists in the world, the climate scientists, do agree that global warming is real, and I think almost all of them believe that it's man-made, at least in part also. Now, the interesting thing here is that Assemblyman Jones has long been a climate change denier, and in fact went so far as to have a conference in San Diego where he invited a very well-known climate change denier to speak. Can you You said you've done a little research on this.
I did. You know, once again, you have to be careful. I'm assuming that my research is accurate. I think the hardest part for everybody is you really need to take the time to do the due diligence.
Yeah, and this guy was Lord
Mockham or something like that. But you know, he might as well be like the Dark Lord on Harry Potter, because you know the House of Lords said the cease and desist to even use the term Lord.
He's clearly not a Lord, and he was claiming he was a member of the House of Lords.
And in his scientific background, in some places he has claimed to be a Lord. I've seen some of his online videos.
Yeah.
His scientific background is basically nil. He's, even though I like literature, I think his background's actually in literature, and that doesn't give you a great background, in my opinion, for science. So I think, you know, parading around, this person, in my opinion, is a charlatan. And I think that everybody has a right to their opinion. I agree with Brian that, you know, you should always have, you know, two sides. There's two sides to a story. But when 97% of the story is a scientist saying that we got a problem here and it's man-made, and 3%, you know, are these charlatans running around. You know, they have these groups like the Heartland Group and places like that where a lot of these guys get paid from.
Yeah, and I want to do a clarification on that, by the way. You're talking about a Heartland Group that's based out of Chicago that is a big think tank that's all about climate change denial. And I just need to make a disclaimer that East County Magazine's parent organization is the nonprofit Heartland Coalition, Heartland Foundation in San Diego, which has absolutely no relation. And in fact, this Heartland here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't even know that.
No, it's okay. They have a United Green and some other things. But we always have to issue that disclaimer that they have absolutely no connection to that other.
But what these organizations do, see, that's why it's so hard to get the truth, is, you know, there's money interests on both sides. And you'll have a group like that that will pay doctors, like years ago, to say, oh, how great smoking was. You know, 9 out of 10 people smoke Camel cigarettes, and, you know, you'll feel great after work to have a nice smoke to relax yourself, when, you know, probably nine out of those 10 doctors probably died of lung cancer.
And yeah, we see a lot of the oil industry puts in a lot of money into sort of trying to debunk climate change, because obviously they're built around a fossil fuel industry. That's their entire profit model. So if you take that away, what happens?
I would agree with that, but I'd also be careful to say, because, you know, without oil companies, I'm not saying that they don't do that, and I suspect in a lot of the circumstances that's exactly what's going on. And this is why they hire these folks like, you know, Lord Mockham, who's not a lord who goes out, and, you know, that was posted he was a lord. And I don't know why Brian Jones didn't do his research. You know, if you're going to post something like that and you're going to attach yourself to somebody, make sure it's somebody who's credible.
So let's go on to some other issues. We've talked about climate and science issues. Where do you stand on some of the social issues, on women's issues and on same-sex marriage, gay rights, some of these things?
Well, you know, the Republicans, you know, it's almost impossible for a Republican, conservative Republican, to get elected if they're pro-choice and they're pro-gay marriage, because, you know, a lot of the conservative, fiscal conservatives have attached themselves to the religious conservatives. I'm a fiscal conservative, and I believe that I'm more fiscally conservative than Brian Jones. You know, Brian Jones didn't vote on a law, for example, about sales tax. I don't know why he didn't vote on that. I would have voted to stop, you know, getting sales tax from people buying, you know, from Amazon and whatnot.
So you support fiscal responsibility.
Fiscal responsibility, totally. But when it comes to the social issues, which is definitely a hot topic in this state, you know, your beliefs are your beliefs. I'm personally, you know, in my life, you know, I'm me and my wife, you know, we're fortunate enough to have a child. We actually have a son coming up here in September. We're personally pro-life. But when it comes to how I would vote and what I believe for other folks, I don't believe that I should impose that on anybody else. I don't think it's my right, you know, to tell a woman what to do with her body. The bottom line is that I'm pro-choice. I just don't see that as being very free telling a woman, you know, who might be in a difficult circumstance, you know, what to do with abortion. Now, that doesn't mean that I like abortion or, for example, I don't like these crazy ideas of these partial birth abortions and things like that. That, I think, is, you know, morally a sin, not even, in, you know, religiously, but morally a sin. But, you know, in the first trimester, somebody, a woman has a need for that. I don't think it's a man's business, and it's Congress is and the legislature is mostly run by men, and they're telling women what to do with their bodies.
And what about the issue of gay rights? Where do you stand on that?
That's another tough topic, because people, you know, when you read the Bible and whatnot, people are going to say in the Bible that, you know, there's certain sections that people wouldn't interpret as being gay, as being a sin. You know, there's even certain sections, I believe, that says that you should stone, you know, gays to death. You know, I think that if you read the Bible, that, you know, you can interpret whatever you want out of
that.
Yeah,
they stone adulterers to death in the Bible, too.
Exactly. So. But I think in today's civilized society that we have to put that aside. that is also for gays. I think that that is not like, you know, a choice. I think they're born that way personally. That's just my personal scientific belief. And I don't think that, you know, you should be trying to convert people who are gay. And I think that, you know, why should you take away their right, just like other heterosexuals, to the privileges of marriages?
You see this as sort of a civil rights or human rights issue.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Totally a civil rights and a human rights issue. And that's where I would differ with the party.
Okay.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Let's go back to fiscal issues a little bit. I've seen on your website that you talk a lot about the need to do more about jobs. We have pretty high poverty rates in portions of this 71st district, El Cajon, for example. What would be your plan for creating more jobs, especially good paying jobs, in East County and throughout the 71st district?
Well, that's interesting. You know, your key thing is good paying jobs, because you see, if it's easier for somebody to sit home and collect, you know, food stamps or some kind of government subsidy, you know, the incentives aren't there. I think everything is about incentives and how you incentivize people, you know, to have a great life. So what I would do, I agree with the Democrats that we need to raise the minimum wage. So I think if you raise the minimum wage, you'll pull people, you know, out of poverty. Now, granted, you will affect some businesses, you know, because maybe they can't survive, you know, but it's going to be a minority. But there's going to be some businesses that couldn't survive at $5 an hour. So it doesn't matter what you put you know, how low you drop it, you know, some businesses are going to fall by the wayside. But I think that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. So I think that the Democrats, you know, I think raising the minimum wage should be something that the Republicans should support. And I think eventually they will see the light on that and will support it. I think that as a fiscal conservative, though, the big things are going to be stuff like giving businesses incentives. See, businesses, you know, they're all about making money. I work at my day job at a bank, you know, and there's not a bank out there that doesn't want to make a profit. But if you give them incentives where they can do the right thing, for example, like give tax incentives where they can hire new workers.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I just saw in the Sacramento Bee yesterday that Governor Brown is coming out with a series of proposed tax incentives to encourage businesses that are here to stay and businesses that are out of state to come here. And it included things like a tax incentive if you hire veterans, for example. And there were about three different, for hiring different kinds of segments. They were doing a pilot program, not San Diego, but some other areas where if you would hire ex-prisoners or you would hire people who've been on public assistance, for example, you get extra tax credits.
Well, I give them accolades for that, because that's the kind of stuff that we need to do. And I think that smart Republicans that see that would definitely support something like that. I mean, you know, Republican Party has been consistently the party of lower taxes and lower government and trying to keep business in the state. But
yeah, this also included, by the way, special tax incentives, I think, for biotech and clean tech and a few of those higher-end things, too, for hiring in those areas.
Oh, I love stuff. This is the stuff that I would support, I would also speak about. So I think that you have to give the businesses incentives to stay here. Totally agree with that.
I would also like to ask you your views on energy. Obviously, you've indicated that you do believe climate change is something that needs to be addressed. But even among those who believe in climate change as a problem, there's quite a discrepancy in what to do about it. Some people would say, let's build more nuclear plants. Some would say, let's build more wind farms. Some would say, let's put the emphasis on things like rooftop solar or sort of the least, you know, destructive path, or more mass transit or energy conservation. What would your solution or mix of solutions be?
Well, first, before you get to a solution, like I work as an engineer, we always try to say, well, what's the root cause of the problem? So, you know, if the root cause, for example, is this burning of fossil fuels, you know, have we gotten to the point where we can actually contain that? Because you see, you know, if the United States is the only country that's curtailing its fossil fuels and the rest of the countries like China, who's now the biggest polluter, you know, are doing things, then, you know, you could be doing all this great stuff in America, but it's going to become moot, and then you lose economic activity and your competitive edge. But then people say, well, what are we doing? Are we just going to give up and just destroy the whole planet, our kids and our grandkids? So I think if we understand the root cause, if the root cause really is, you know, us polluting too much, we have to work together in the global community and say, hey, you know, the Kyoto protocols and things like that, get together and say, can we do something? Or is it too late? Are we just all going to die in 200 years? You know, I wrote a book. My new book is called Extinction, you know.
Maybe that's...
Maybe
well, that's very timely, isn't it?
But I think that if we agree, if the scientists and the people get together and we agree that we can actually do something as a world to make it better, because it's not fair to America to be cutting back, you know, energy and yeah. jobs and things, because it's going to affect us. But I do think stuff like solar, I love solar, but I don't think that, you know, we can't let big business, you know, dictate it. Like I looked at the wind turbine, you know, issue that you talked about, Noctilo. We can't have something that goes in there and then you only get 50% of the power, for example.
We need some more accountability. In other words, maybe taking a closer look at these proposals to make sure a project is really viable as sort of the basic starting point for them.
Yeah, but Ocotillo, for example, if they're only getting 50% of the power that they promised the public to get, right?
Which is true.
I haven't studied that, but I trust you on that, Miriam. And if that's the case, then maybe they should only get 50% of the money, you know, payments, you know, for the work that they did. See, we have to have accountability, as you said. I think all legislation has to have accountability.
Right. There you go. We're seeing, perhaps as a result of climate change, we're in the worst drought in 100 years. We're seeing issues of wells going dry, water running low in portions of East County, and very severe fire dangers. We've obviously had the worst wildfires in the state history right here more than once, and yet we're still seeing projects that pose big fire dangers being proposed. Do you have any ideas for strengthening fire protection out here, Tony?
Well, with climate change, you know, that the word speaks for itself. I mean, the climate is changing, and you're seeing things like the droughts and whatnot. So we have to work smart. I think that you can't, if you decide to put your home in an area that has like a 75% chance of burning down in 5 years, you know, you should, maybe you're, if you decide to do that, I think people should be free, but then their insurance rates, you know, they shouldn't be charging other folks for the insurance or the cost for the infrastructure and things like that. So I think that has to be equitable. I don't think it's smart. I think we should be really careful with our zoning and building to make sure that we're not building in areas that, you know, have high rates of fire, or that we're making sure that the fire, the infrastructure is in place. It has to be balanced. Growth. And I think what we do is a lot of unbalanced growth in this state, and then it costs us and we can't afford it.
Yeah, and at the same token, on the other side of the coin would be, even if we stopped growth in those areas, if a major fire starts out there and we don't have enough manpower to stop it, then it can roar through and certainly threaten even the urban areas. They had evacuations all the way to Solano Beach during 2007, for example.
Well, we definitely need, I think, see, as an engineer, I like the idea of looking at the data and analyzing it and coming up with conclusions. If the analysis shows, and I think that it will show this, that we're understaffed and underfunded for our fire, you know, support and our fire stations and whatnot, and we don't have the personnel and the boots on the ground, then we as a society have to say, okay, how do we fund this? You know, I have no problem with shifting funds from other areas that are less important. I think that, but the voters need to be involved in this. You know, you can't just go out like Brown did, I think, and create this fire tax that was,
yeah,
in my opinion, unconstitutional. It didn't get, I think he required 2/3, and he created it as a fee and tried skirting the law just to get the money. And you know, I mean, you know, he did. It sounds like he's doing some great stuff on trying to create incentives for business, but on the issue of the fire tax, I totally oppose what he did.
Yeah. So in other words, you think that's something that should go before voters to have a choice in if there's going to be a fire tax or fee, and at the same token, maybe they should look at drawing money from other portions of the budget that are perhaps less critical in order to make sure that we have adequate firefighting.
Totally. And I would, you know, I have no problem paying the money. I just would like to be represented.
That makes sense. Now, what about Second Amendment rights, guns? Brian Jones is a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. He actually holds a lot of his events out here at gun clubs and things like that. Where do you stand on Second Amendment rights?
Well, as a member of the National Rifle Association, the NRA, I'm a firm believer in the Second Amendment rights. I'm also a believer in all the amendments. I sent you a flyer earlier, but, you know, I believe strongly in the Constitution. I like a lot of what Ron Paul says about the Constitution. I think that, unfortunately, a lot of our Constitution has been shredded. The Second Amendment, I'm a firm believer in the right to bear arms, keep and bear arms. But with that said, and this is where the controversial, you know, stuff comes in with the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. I don't like to have those rights shredded, but I do believe that in a civilized society, that I don't have a problem with a small waiting period that's reasonable, because I think that, you know, if you don't want somebody, if you're living in a big city, someone, you know, maybe a crime of passion, walking into a gun shop and buying a gun. We're not living in the wild west.
So you would support, say, waiting periods to and a background check to buy a gun.
Of course, but within reason. You know, what happens is these things are slippery slopes, and that's why the Republicans stand really hard on this, is because as soon as you give a little bit, you know, I firmly believe there's a lot of folks out there who love nothing better than to ban all guns, and I think that's absolutely wrong. Yeah.
Now, what about education? You have attended, it sounds like, both public and private institutions in your day. What are your views on education? We've certainly seen California slipping somewhat in terms of the very high educational achievements and test scores and things in some of the recent years. Do you have a plan for improving that?
For office, yes, I do have some plans. But I think that, you know, all of us in our private and daily lives can actually do something. You know, I mentioned earlier that I work at a bank. I work at Union Bank doing computer work. And it was kind of nice that our, you know, our EVP in charge of the whole mortgage business said, hey, Tony, we should do something to help the bank out here and, you know, and hire local. So, you know, I worked with UCSD locally to try to, we're trying to do programs. I think all businesses should try to do things, you know, actually do something. Now, what can legislators do to make it better? You know, a lot of times, the problem is that sometimes you give more money to something and actually you get the opposite results is a sad thing. If you look at like the unfunded pension liabilities and things like that, it's given like a bad name to education. I think without strong education, our free civilized society is going to crumble. And that's why education is one of the top things on my list.
So you see it as an investment in our future.
We have to invest in education, but we got to do it smart.
What about the increasing cost of college education? We're seeing more and more kids priced out of that as tuitions just keep going up and up and up at UC and the CSU system.
Crazy. Absolutely unsustainable and crazy. I think what we're doing is we're bankrupting our students, our children. And what's going to happen is that a lot of them, unfortunately, because of the economy and these other problems that we're having, you know, they're getting burdened with these massive student loans that they're not going to be able to pay back. And I predict that there will be another fiscal crisis with the student loans, that they'll have to bail out the student loans, and all the taxpayers are going to have to start paying for a lot of this. I think that the prices somehow have to go down. We can't burden our kids with those kind of prices.
Now, we've talked a lot about things that are worth, in your opinion, the investment, worth spending money on. On the other hand, where do the revenues come from for that? Do you have any ideas for increasing revenues for the state of California?
Everybody talks about increasing revenue, and I think that...
Which doesn't necessarily mean, you know, raising taxes,
right,
or new taxes. It could,
right,
mean... You know, there's other ways to do that, but I'm just curious what your ideas are.
We're a state with the most natural resources, right? You know, if you look at the 50 states, I mean, Alaska also has quite a few resources, and Texas has oil and whatnot.
Yeah, and incidentally, Alaska, they do a wellhead oil tax, which so far Republicans usually oppose that, but we're the only oil-producing state, I understand, with no wellhead oil tax.
That's interesting. And what I would look at is that, first and foremost, I would look at where we're not doing things smart, because I do think that even in business, that sometimes throwing money at something doesn't make it better. So first I would have like put together a team, you know, in the state legislature of a group of folks that could get together and say, you know, who are like-minded and say, what's going on here? You know, what can we do to help the education, you know, system in California? Where is there waste? Can we do stuff with like online universities that make sense? Can we cut some of this unfunded pension liability somehow, renegotiate certain contracts? I mean, I don't think you should have 24,000, whatever it is, folks making over $100,000 a year, you know, in pensions when everybody else is struggling. And look at where we can cut first. And then once we've cut, we said, look, there's nothing else that we can cut here. We have to raise revenue, right? So how are you going to do that? I would take the, you know, things of like the richest companies that, you know, aren't going to like leave the state, you know, because, you know, when you tax a business, the first thing they're going to do is say, well, is it cheaper to go someplace else?
Right.
But if they're real true partners, I think you can give incentives to business to do partnership programs, because those are the students that are going to work for those companies.
Yeah, so some of the things we talked about, like the hiring incentives, where that would actually...
Yeah.
Encourage more businesses to come here, or the ones that are here to stay, and then the state,
right,
is raising revenues.
Maybe the companies that make deals with the universities where they subsidize some of the top students, so when the students graduate, you know, they get jobs at these universities, or they create, you know, partnerships. I think if you work with business and universities and create these nice partnerships.
Like apprenticeship programs?
Exactly.
Like that.
I remember when I was in Rutgers, we used to have partnerships like Intel, and the government used to be there. And it was great because the kids got opportunities and they immediately got jobs.
Well, I want to thank you very much, for Tony, for coming in. Can you tell folks where exactly the 71st Assembly District is, which communities are included in that.
The funny thing is that I've been living in this area and I couldn't even name all the towns when I first looked at it because it's a lot of it's in the East County.
Roughly,
you know, I live in Julian, which I love Julian. And so it includes places like Julian, Ramona's in there, El Cajon's in there, Desconsolo, Hummel.
So pretty much south all the way to the border and east all the way to the Imperial County line. And how far north does it go?
Oh, boy. It goes
west.
West as far as El Cajon, I think, is mm-hmm. in the district. Auntie's in there, too, of course, where we are here. Mm-hmm. And it goes down almost to Mexico, almost. You know.
And then up to, I think, the Riverside County line.
Sure, sure.
We have been speaking with Tony Teora, that's Teora. He is the Republican candidate who is challenging Brian Jones in the 71st Assembly District, Assemblyman Brian Jones. He is one of the only two people whose names are listed on the ballot in this race. There is no Democrat on the ballot.
Thank you. You know, I looked at your website and your show, and it looks like you guys have a great magazine and a great show here. And I'm honored to be here. I want to thank you very much for the time.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you, Tony, for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thanks.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email. Or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
There's a new Speaker of the Assembly in California, and she's from San Diego. Former San Diego Councilwoman Toni Atkins was sworn in Monday in Sacramento. I'm grateful to my Assembly colleagues for selecting me for this honor and responsibility, says Atkins. After several years of deficits and financial challenges created by the Great Recession, California has finally begun down the path of stabilization and growing prosperity. I look forward to working with Assembly members on both sides of the aisle and the governor as we take advantage of this opportunity to continue laying a sound financial foundation for our state. Atkins is a true rags-to-riches story. Daughter of a coal miner, she grew up in rural Virginia, a home without running water, where her mother cooked on wood stove and the family could not afford health insurance. Atkins has made health care and affordable housing priorities in her legislative career, as well as women's rights and gay rights. Atkins is the first openly gay legislator to lead the California Assembly. She has also served as a manager and director of services at a woman's clinic. In San Diego, she pushed through a declaration of a citywide housing emergency and requirement for developers to offer affordably priced housing units in new home projects. She briefly served as San Diego's interim mayor after Dick Murphy resigned, and Murphy's replacement, Michael Zucchet, also resigned amid a corruption scandal, though charges against him were later dropped. Atkins served until the election of Mayor Jerry Sanders several months later. Sanders has credited Atkins with helping him reach the decision to support same-sex marriages. Though progressive in her politics, Atkins has won praise across the aisle for her integrity and for being respectful to those with different views. Atkins represents San Diego's 78th Assembly District, covering coastal regions from the border north to Solana Beach. Having a San Diegan in charge of running the State Assembly also means increased influence for the region in the halls of power in Sacramento. The Speaker is in charge of overall management and supervision of the Assembly. She appoints members to all committees and subcommittees, allocates funds, staffing, and other resources for the effective operation of the House, and establishes committee schedules. The Speaker is also responsible for making or recommending numerous appointments to state boards and commissions. And she serves on the University of California Board of Regents and the California State University Board of Trustees. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. CAL FIRE investigators have determined that the July 6, 2013 Chariot Fire southwest of Julian was caused by a Jeep Wrangler that was owned and operated by the Bureau of Land Management. The Jeep ignited dry vegetation under the vehicle, CAL FIRE's report concluded, and it included photos showing firefighters putting out a fire underneath that Jeep. The CAL FIRE finding confirms allegations previously made by an attorney who has filed suit on behalf of fire victims, and he indicated that a private investigation previously revealed evidence that the BLM Jeep started the blaze. The Chariot Fire started in eastern San Diego County, near Butterfield Ranch Resort and the Great Southern Overland Stage Route on land managed by the BLM. It burned over 7,000 acres on federal and public lands and destroyed 149 structures, including a historic lodge, cabins at the Shrine Camp, and other structures. Over 2,100 firefighters battled the fire during the 10-day siege to contain the blaze. Chief Dale Hutchison with CAL FIRE says it's critical that everyone be extra cautious outdoors with any activity that may cause a spark. This year especially, he said, we need the public to remember that one less spark means one less wildfire. For more tips on preventing wildfires, visit www.preventwildfireca.org. Welcome to Job Talk, bringing you news about great jobs and growing our regional economy.
This is Ed Barena with today's Jobs Talk Report. California Governor Jerry Brown is introducing a set of tax credits aimed at keeping companies and jobs in California. The $750 million package also includes incentives to convince out-of-state employers to move to California. These tax credits will spur new jobs and help communities hardest hit by the recession, Governor Brown said. His plan would reduce the amount of sales tax paid by businesses buying equipment for manufacturing, food processing, biotech, research, and development. It also includes a California Competes income tax credit for employers that invest in new jobs in California. In addition, employers can receive a new employment credit on their income taxes if they increase hiring of veterans, recipients of public assistance, and ex-prisoners in areas with high poverty and unemployment levels, though at present, San Diego is not included in the designated areas for that new employment credit. If the program proves effective at reducing the government's costs for public assistance and unemployment benefits, then potentially the plan could be expanded in the future.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Kenny Weisberg, author of Off My Rocker, One Man's Tasty, Twisted, Star-Studded Quest for Everlasting Music. My guest has produced and hosted 2,500 radio shows for 8 different stations from 1971 to 2007. He's also been music critic, concert promoter, and rock and roll singer with Kenny and the Critics. In addition, Kenny Weisberg has the distinction of producing San Diego's internationally acclaimed Humphrey's Concerts by the Bay, which began 23 years ago, as well as his award-winning Music Without Boundaries radio show. That's a long resume. Welcome, Kenny. It's a pleasure having you on our program.
Thank you. Humphrey's has actually been going on for 33 years, and I was there from season 2 to season 25.
Really?
So I left Humphrey's about 7 years ago and decided to write a book about it.
Well, we have a lot of information in this book. Let's start with the specifics of your book, and then we'll go to the Humphrey concerts, because we definitely want to hear about that. Tell us a little bit about your music background in general. How did you get involved with playing music? And what is your first love? Is it the playing, the promoting, the critiquing, the what is it?
Well, it all dates back to the transistor radio that my parents gave me when I was 7. It was the dawning of the rock and roll era in 1955, and I was one of these kids that slept with the transistor radio under my pillow, and I would turn it on, and growing up on the East Coast, the radio there was just infectious, and I fell in love. It was the era of Elvis Presley and Bill Haley and the Comets and Sonny James and Charlie Gracie and all this unbelievable rockabilly music was starting to seep into the collective zeitgeist, and it hooked me. And so radio was my first love as a listener. And then when I was at my 8th birthday party, I announced to my friends and to my parents that I was going to be a disc jockey. And they all laughed and then passed out the Davy Crockett coonskin caps as party favors. And I never thought that I would ever really be in radio, but back then I made that announcement. And fast forward about 15 years, I moved to Boulder, Colorado, and got a job at an underground FM radio station, and it started an on-again, off-again 36-year experience in radio. So I would say that radio was the vehicle that opened doors to everything else. There were newspaper and magazine editors that used to listen to my radio show in Colorado and called me up and said, "Why don't you write about music?" And I said, "Well, I haven't given that much thought." And then they gave me assignments. And that led to me being a journalist as well. And I wrote over 1,000 magazine articles and newspaper articles for about 10, 12 years. And then being a music critic kind of opened the doors to be me becoming a performer, because the musicians in Colorado that I might have said something unkind about or criticized, I mean, I wasn't a softball critic. I wasn't a hardball, shock jock kind of nasty critic, but I called it as I saw it, and there were some musicians that took exception and would take me aside on the street or in a bar, back me into the wall and say, "I'd like to see what you could do."
Really?
And so I said to myself, you know, something that's a very valid point, because most music critics are not musicians. And I had been a closet musician since the Beatles came out in the 60s, and I bought my first Stella guitar and learned how to play all the Beatles songs. So I said, okay, I'm 32 years old. I'm sort of underemployed. Why don't I put a band together? And I did, and I thought it would be a one-shot deal. That was Kenny and the Critics. And it ended up lasting for 3.5 years.
What kind of music did you play?
It was a rock and roll band. If I was going to compare it to anyone, I would compare it to my East Coast roots. This was back in 1980 to 83. I emulated Bruce Springsteen, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, Garland Jeffries, the Iron City House Rockers. I loved all of that East Coast urban pump it out rock and roll. Elvis Costello, a lot of British influences as well. And so we played the bars and theaters in Boulder, Colorado for 3.5 years. And then out of nowhere, I got a job offer to move to San Diego and become a concert producer.
Wow. So one thing stacked on top of the other. You've really lived your dream.
I have, and I continue to, actually. Moving to San Diego, I never really envisioned myself producing concerts. But a guy that used to listen to me on the radio, again, another door that radio opened, said, "Let me fly you out to San Diego. I just bought a concert company in San Diego, and one of the things they do, they put really quaint little concerts on at this hotel called the Humphreys Half Moon Inn." This is back in 1983. So I was 35 years old. I was very sort of broke. I had a wife and 2 kids, and I wasn't really providing for them. And my career in radio, journalism, and performing really added up to very little.
Right.
And this person offered me a real starting salary and benefits. And I said, yeah, but it's being a concert promoter. I always thought of concert promoters as bottom line corporate kind of guys.
Accountants.
Didn't care about the music. It was just, you know, like get them in here, you know, charge for the parking, charge for the popcorn, charge for the drinks. But then I flew out here. And I saw Humphreys, which was really small at the time. The stage was a foot off the ground or 2 feet off the ground. They had like 6 or 7 lights that were literally hanging off of trees. But I said, you know something? This could be a gold mine. And I don't mean it in a gold mine in terms of raking in gold, but just the ambiance at Humphreys is spectacular. It's right on the water on Shelter Island. In Point Loma, and you look off to the side of the stage and you see a flotilla of everything from yachts to dinghies and kayaks. And I said, wow, I think the artists would love playing here, and I think that fans would like coming to Humphreys. And so I convinced the owner of the hotel, who really looked at the concerts not as a nuisance, but he didn't really embrace them like he's a hotelier. He wasn't a concert promoter, but he sort of let me run with it, and so I ended up spending the next 23 years of my life there producing concerts. We built a bigger stage. The owner of the hotel threw a lot of money into making it a state-of-the-art facility, and now Humphreys, I think, is celebrating their 33rd year. I'm proud to be part of the legacy.
And you really made your vision come to fruition.
It was fortunate. It was a lot of hard work. And if you read Off My Rocker, which is the book that I wrote about all this, you'll find out that it wasn't just a bed of roses. I mean, I dealt with a lot of questionable behavior on other people's part. The behavior of other people that was bad sort of morphed into me, and I became someone that I didn't really like either. And I saw it happening in front of my very eyes, that I was becoming as greedy as the people that I railed against in the past as a journalist, that I was cutting corners. It's interesting reading. I'm glad to say that I've survived all my bad behavior, and I think I ended up being a good person. But for a while, the lure of money and drugs and bad activities had a hold of me.
So your book really gives not only a view of the exciting, but the darker side of this exciting field of music.
Yes, yes. And of course, the artists that I've dealt with as well, be careful what you wish for sometimes, because I really wanted to meet my heroes. All of a sudden, I'm in a position of a concert, being a concert promoter, spending someone else's money to present these concerts. I was like a kid in a candy store. So I booked Chuck Berry. I booked Fats Domino. I booked the Everly Brothers. I booked Roy Orbison. We were the first people to present a headlining Whitney Houston concert when she was 22 years old and no one knew who she was. So the people that I got to meet were just amazing. But some of them weren't so amazing.
Right.
Some of them were really bad people and put me through torment and hell, and I write about a lot of that in the
right.
book.
I write about the good people. They're not just icons, right?
Yes, yes. And I won't name names on this interview, but if you get off my rocker, you'll see that some of your rock and roll heroes are not who you would expect them to be.
Right. Well, I know your book has also been called a rock memoir, offering a true education in American music history. What about the educational part? What do readers learn about music history in your book?
Well, other than the specific artists, some of whom I've mentioned already, whether I have stories about Bonnie Raitt and Lyle Lovett and some people that are still making music today. It's not just the Fats Dominoes and the Jerry Lee Lewis's of the world. But what this book is it's for anyone that's ever fantasized about being in the music business on any level. I write about the behind-the-scenes machinations of the concert industry. You know, what acts cost, the bidding wars that go on, the competition. And so people that have aspirations of being in the concert business, it's sort of like a how not to book, or as opposed to a how to book, or what not to. It also goes behind the scenes of San Diego radio. I did a radio show called Music Without Boundaries for 14 years. And I worked for 5 different radio stations in San Diego, all of them different kind of stations, all of them in different locations in San Diego. One of them actually was in Santee. I worked for KPRI for a while, and it was in the KCBQ building in downtown Santee. So people that want to learn about what goes on behind the scenes of right. radio stations, I have a lot of tasty morsels about that. I also put together a rock and roll band from scratch. And that is a challenging and interesting thing to do. So if there is anyone out there, and you don't have to be 13 to do it. I was right. 32 when I mm-hmm. started my first band. And so I talk about the highs and lows of being a performing musician. So educationally, you can look at any of the facets of the music business mm-hmm. and kind of learn what to do and what not to do.
Right. And how to book for something you don't learn in school, right?
right. It's a very streetwise book.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned being a critic, and I know you've written almost 1,000 newspaper and magazine articles for 17 publications. How was it different writing a memoir versus articles?
Well, I was my own boss when I was writing the memoir. Mm-hmm. When I wrote the articles, I had deadlines. And I didn't do anything really in advance. I had an assignment, or I created my own assignments. They were all short form, whether, 500, 1,000 words, or mm-hmm. maybe the long features might have been 5,000 words. This book is like a 100,000 word book. I didn't have a publisher when I started writing the book, and it was just a series I started writing a series of stories. I would write about a concert experience one day, like how Chuck Berry extorted money from me 5 minutes before he took the stage in 1987. And then I would write about moving to San Diego, and I told different stories, and they were in a box on the floor, and I didn't really know if I was going to put it together or what I was going to do with it. I also, when I was a journalist, I kept journals as well. Mm-hmm. So I have journals and day timers, and I know every concert that I've ever been to in my life and the date of the concert. I know every movie I've ever been to. So I had this books and books of information. And I go, well, how am I going to put all this together? How am I going to impart this knowledge? And I started writing it. I said, well, maybe my kids and grandkids will be interested. But then it caught a publisher's eye in Boulder, and she loved it, and she became my publisher, editor, book designer. Her name is Sandra Jonas, and I'm sort of her maiden voyage as a publishing company. I'm the first book on her imprint. She used to work for other publishing houses, and so just as I was about to quit and I didn't know what to do, an editor came into my life, took 400 pages of what I had written, chopped 100 with me. and so the long-winded answer to your very poignant short question is that the long form without deadlines was much more challenging than writing 1,000 words with a deadline of Thursday sure. at 5 o'clock. Because I could just whip those out. They were all first takes. This book, I spent 2 years editing it. And I found out from my editor that I have a bad habit with dangling modifiers.
And you never knew about that.
I didn't even know what they were, but she pointed it out to me that, you should put this adjective here. You shouldn't start a sentence with this, adverb. I go, okay. So it was a very meticulous, time-consuming, sometimes emotionally crippling process.
Yes. And have you fallen in love with it, though?
I'd like to say yes, but I just don't know. I know that when we were talking off mic, you were saying, what's next for you? Is there another book?
That's my next question.
There are several other books. I think the one thing that made me nervous about this book and writing a memoir in general is how honest I had to be to make it work. Mm-hmm. And in being honest, I had to write about family members and go over the stuff with them to make sure that it was okay that I revealed right. certain things about my family dynamic. I had to go over stuff with friends that were involved in some of the bad behavior that I talked about. I changed some of their names, but I was very conscious. You know, I'm telling the truth in this book, and the one that who ends up looking the worst in the book is me. So I wasn't worried about besmirching someone else. But I thought to myself, you know, something. If I had fictionalized this, I wouldn't have these worries. I could just make it fiction. So I think the next book I'd like to try fiction.
Okay.
And I have many ideas, but I'm busy still promoting this one, and I'm not like a real writer that is already thinking three books ahead. Are you that kind of writer?
I am, but you have a wealth of experience that I think could be translated into all kinds of fiction if you wanted to, but it is a lot of work.
I'll look to Urena to be my coach as I proceed to the next project.
One last, I don't know if it's a question, but can you tell us the anecdote that stands out most in your mind, whether it's a legend that you met at a particular concert? Is there one very, very small story that you can leave us with?
Sure. And it's in the book, so maybe I won't give the punchline away.
Okay.
I loved Aretha Franklin. I still love Aretha Franklin. And when I would go to work every day to book a concert series, I shoot for the moon. I try to get Bob Dylan, who I never presented. I try to get Bruce Springsteen, who's way too big for a 1,400-seat venue like Humphrey's.
Right.
And I tried to get Aretha Franklin every year. And that was complicated by the fact that she doesn't like to fly. She lives in Detroit and, you know, never. The last time she had played in San Diego was 1972 at a stadium concert. And I tried every year, year after year. And finally, in what was going to be my next to last year as a concert promoter, her agent said, yeah, Aretha wants to play Humphreys this year.
Oh, exciting.
And I said, wow. And so I usually negotiate offers, and it's a cat and mouse game with the agents. And they go, well, we want $100,000. I go, well, I'll give you $65,000. And then, you know, you agree at $80,000 or whatever. Aretha Franklin, I just said, tell me what the cost will be, and I'll tell you what the ticket price. I said, I don't want to negotiate with you. I want to present this show. So he said, she'll do it for $150,000. I said, wow, well, the ticket price will have to be $140. And we had never charged more than $98. Now, you know, I think Steely Dan at Humphrey's this year is $185 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we got Aretha Franklin confirmed, and I was floating on cloud nine. And the day of the show, her agent called and said, Aretha wants you to pay her in cash the balance of the guarantee. So I had to go to the bank and get $75,000 in cash and take it to her room at the Hotel Del Coronado. And I walked into her room, and all of a sudden, I have an audience with Lady Soul Aretha Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
And I write about it in detail, what went on that day.
So you really liked her.
I did, but it was a strange experience. You have to read about it. We don't have the time
right.
for me to get
into. We look forward to reading about her and everyone else. Our time is up, Kenny, but thank you so much for joining us.
Raina, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
For more information on Kenny Weisberg and his work, please visit his website at www.kennyweisberg.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road.
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.